and welcome to the KunstlerCast. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Doug Hill, author of Not So Fast, Thinking Twice About Technology. Doug's a journalist and an independent scholar who's studied the history and philosophy of technology for more than 25 years. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Atlantic, Salon, and Esquire magazine. He's the co-author of the bestseller Saturday Night, a backstage history of Saturday Night Live, and he lives in Pasadena, California. I have only one advertiser on this podcast, and that is David McIlvaney's ICA Financial Advisors. I happen to be a big fan of David's weekly financial podcast, and there's a link to it in the show notes. We are living in rather strange financial times, and by now you realize that you need to own physical precious metals in your portfolio, whether in your possession, in an IRA, or stored internationally. It's imperative that you work with a company that advises you on and manages your gold and silver. ICA has been an industry leader since 1972. Your ICA advisor will get you set up correctly from the start and keep you informed about when to make a move, when to add ounces, and even assist you with an exit strategy as the markets change. Call 1-800-525-9556 for a free portfolio review. That's 1-800-525-9556. Or go to icagoldcompany.com to request information. I'm talking to Doug Hill, the author of Not So Fast, Thinking Twice About Technology, and I kind of think we should think about it maybe three or four or five times. And it's a wonderfully written book and quite a deep dive into many of the quandaries and predicaments around technology. These are issues that many people are thinking about these days, but not a whole lot of conclusions have been drawn about it. So first, Doug, how would you even define technology just to get us launched on some baseline of understanding?
That's a great question. It's one I talk about in one of the chapters of the book of what is technology. And I'm reluctant to give my own definition, but I suppose it would be the tools that we use to shape and alter nature and reality. The important thing for me about technology is that it's not just a machine. It is a technology is a system, and it is tied into culture and society and politics. All of these things come into play when you're talking about technology. So, and this is a big debate among philosophers of technology, is how narrowly should we define it or how broadly we should define it. And I am on the side of the argument that says that we should think of technology in broad terms. One thing is very important. Technology is not just digital technology, which is a common misperception. Journalists today often use technology as shorthand to talk about digital technology, social media and the internet, etc. And one of the central arguments of my book is that digital technologies are part of a continuum that has continued really through history, but certainly especially since the Industrial Revolution. And there are commonalities that we ought to recognize and appreciate that tie digital technologies to the technologies that preceded them.
You make the point, which I think is an excellent one, that technologies are all connected and their effects radiate out. One of the ideas you reference is John Michael Greer's idea that technologies exist in suites of technology, and that these things require each other in some kind of sequence to be discovered and employed in order for this kind of technological progress to happen, of course. My question about that is, these things all work on the way up in their development, you know, as we go up the techno staircase. But what happens on the way down if any of these unravel? It seems to me that there's a lot of opportunity for cascading failure and fragility.
Yes, I agree with that very much. And that goes back again to the point that these technologies are interconnected. And it's important to note that a technology that's invented doesn't exist by itself. It has to have a whole series of related technologies built up and connected around it. The obvious example is the automobile. The automobile would be very limited in its use if we didn't have a system of roads, if we didn't have a system of fuel to power them, a system of regulations and enforcement to make sure that people don't kill each other more than they do. It's incredibly complex, and you talk about complexity a lot in your books, which I really appreciate, but the systems that have to be implemented to support a given technology are just unbelievable. And again, going to digital technologies, I mean, think of the various systems that have to be put into place to bring an iPhone to your house and put it in your hands and have you be able to use it. I mean, it's just incredibly complicated. So if any of those systems start to break down, to go back to your question, there's a sort of a domino effect that takes place. If a piece of that infrastructure falls apart, then it all pretty quickly collapses. And there was just a couple of days ago, two countries, Uruguay and Argentina, were without power for almost the entire country for 2 days or so. And there's also quite a bit of publicity lately about the United States trying to establish systems of cyber warfare within Russia's electronics, electrical power infrastructure, in response to the cyber warfare techniques that Russia has apparently already installed in the American electrical infrastructure. It doesn't appear to be much of a challenge at this point for those systems to be disrupted in a fundamental way.
Yeah, I was waiting for that to happen. You know, when were we going to get to the point where we could mutually just turn each other off?
I think we're there, apparently. Yeah,
apparently.
Those techniques are not limited to they're available to other countries besides Russia and the United States. So we're living in a very vulnerable technological world right now.
Doug, tell me what you mean by the technological imperative.
The technological imperative. Well, that is a term that I use in the book that is related to the technological imperative, is de facto technological autonomy. And both of those terms refer to the fact that we're basically committed at this point to a technological way of life, whether we like it or not. The people who can successfully withdraw from technology in any fundamental way are committing themselves to living a life that's nothing close to what the 99.9% of us in America certainly are accustomed to. I was just leafing through your book, Too Much Magic, last night, and I appreciated that you made the acknowledgement that if you were taken out and put in a primitive culture, you would be dead pretty quickly. And I'm certainly in that camp myself. But the point is that we don't have a choice. We are dependent on technology. And that, of course, is one of the great disasters and tragedy of the climate change, global warming situation. The changes in the way of life of Americans and people all over the world that would be required to successfully deal with climate change are just fundamental. I live in Pasadena, California, and I'm within a mile of being an overpass where I can look at a California, one of the main Los Angeles freeways, the 210. And any time of the day or night, I can go and stand there, probably not in the middle of the night. I haven't tried that, but almost any time during the day or night, I can witness bumper to bumper traffic going to and from Los Angeles. What would we do? How would we deal with the fact that we don't have the gas to power our cars, or we don't have any of the technologies that are necessary to sustain that system that incredibly complex and incredibly expensive and incredibly destructive system that we're all use on a daily basis.
Herb Stein put it nicely when he said, you know, things work until they don't.
Yeah, right. But look out when they don't. I mean, you know, we're all very vulnerable. I am as much as anybody. I mean, you and I are talking on Skype. I use my computer as a writer every day, and I'm looking at, there's some light. It's a cloudy day here, so the lights are on in my house. And, you know, I don't like it when the temperature in Pasadena gets up over 100 degrees and I turn on my air conditioner. You know, we could do without a lot of this stuff if and when we had to, but it won't be pretty.
Yeah. By the way, whatever happened to Alvin Toffler's idea of future shock? It was a pretty good concept. You know, it was succinct and right on, and it seems like our society has forgotten it.
Yeah, I mentioned that in my book. It surprises me, too. And I think it's just an example of how we, you know, sort of absorb things and, you know, shit them out and then go on about our business. And what's the next headline on of the day? But, yeah, we're all living in future shock. And as you know, one of the things that I talk about a lot in my book is the fact that future shock has been causing psychological, deeply disturbing psychological effects in culture, at least since the Industrial Revolution. And people talk about during the Industrial Revolution, it was well recognized. And I quote a lot of these. It's remarkable how familiar the warnings and signs of distress were in the 19th century, the same kind of thing that we're going through now. And of course, everybody says, and Toffler said, it's accelerating. I think that's true. And look at the psychological state of the United States.
Oh, yeah, it's miserable. You mention in the book this recognition by late 19th century writers that industrial technology and its reverberations are bringing on all these strange new negative states of mind, which they labeled in a way that now sounds quaint, anime, neurasthenia.
Yes.
My favorite was American Nervousness.
Yes, that was a book.
Yeah. Yeah. Today, you know, those words are not in common parlance, but we do recognize depression, anxiety, anime, ennui, purposelessness, you know, et cetera. We do seem to be now a deeply neurotic or semi-psychotic culture with a lot of people with kind of personalities that are just floundering.
Oh, man, the dysfunction is unbelievable. I was just talking last night to a guy who's a college, a psychiatrist or psychologist at one of the major universities in Southern California, and he affirmed he's been there doing this for like 30 years, and he says the increase in the amount of depression and suicidal and addiction behaviors is just remarkable. As our dependence on technology accelerates, so do the ramifications of that psychologically. You know, in the 19th century, Durkheim wrote a book, Emil Durkheim, who coined the term anomie, wrote a book on suicide and on the incredible increases in suicide that were occurring in countries across Europe. And he attributed it directly to the acceleration of change due to new technologies that was causing people to become disoriented, and old ways of life, traditional ways of life, were being left behind, and people were floundering because of it. And now, in today's culture, we see regular reports that suicide in the United States is increasing. Part of the irony of that is that technology was supposed to deliver us to this paradise where none of us would have to work and we'd all be able to lie around and read books and eat grapes. it hasn't happened yet, but we're assured that it's just around the corner.
Yeah. You reference the author of the 1970s cult classic, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert Persig. He was playing with a notion that came to him out of actually ancient Greek, classical Greek philosophy, a notion that he called quality. It sounds like something we would all understand. It's a word that we do use, and it's not that difficult a word. But what did Persig's notion of quality coming out of the Greeks mean, and where does it fit in to your view of the technological quandary?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, Jim, because Persig himself had a very difficult time in the book answering it and was, frankly, pretty vague.
Yeah, and he was kind of a tortured individual who himself was suffering from techno-itis.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. And for listeners who are not familiar with it, I personally, it's been a real touchstone in my life. His thoughts on technology are, as you suggest, somewhat ambivalent. And it turns out later in the book that he becomes, he has a breakdown of his own. Quality, I think, has to do with, it's a state of consciousness, really, that involves caring and attention and a kind of a focus. It's almost a Zen idea. And again, Persig's definition of it was a little bit hard to pin down. It very much, I think, describes a state of consciousness that technology tends to drive us away from, because there's a sense of being awake and aware of the world that we're in and our place in it and what's happening at the given moment that is narrowed, I think. And this is a debate that people in the philosophy of technology get into. And there's a school of thought by some people who talk about these things that we're every bit as alive and awake when we're on our smartphones as we are when we're walking in the forest. I don't believe that.
Let me interrupt you for a moment because,
sure,
you know, there is one way of looking at it that could tend to confusion, and that is a point of view that would come out of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's notion of flow.
Yes.
Flow states, because clearly there are a lot of technologists and technologically bound people who get into flow states with their computers. That is not the same as the kind of care and attention necessarily that you're talking about. And there was that other author whose name I've forgotten who wrote about the workshop and the quality of being in the workshop.
I forget his name too.
Yeah, and it kind of implies that kind of care and attention that we attribute to the idea of quality is actually connected to the physical world and to an active role in the physical world, not, you know, a passive receptive role in it.
I think those are all good points. As you know, there's a chapter in my book on abstraction, and I think that technology, one of the directions in which technology tends to take us is to removal from the physical world into sort of a mental, almost a trance state. Persig would have argued in favor of that interpretation because he talks a lot of in the book about the joys of riding on a motorcycle as opposed to being shut up in a car, which is a fairly elemental expression of that issue. I just finished a book called Coders by an author named Clive Thompson, who's been sort of a techno enthusiast for a long time, but he's a superb journalist and an honest guy. And he spent however long it took him to write this book, and he's been very tied into Silicon Valley culture for a long time. And this book is about the psychology and personality of the people who are doing the actual work of coding, the geeks who are driving digital culture. And he's very honest and straightforward about saying how limited these people are in a personal and psychological sense. And the focus that they proudly profess and attain is one in which they, you know, are very accustomed to spending, you know, 48 hours at a stretch sitting in front of their machines, eating fast foods and talking to nobody, considering any human contact and interruption. And that's an extreme version of what I think is a very tempting psychological state for any of us, including myself, to get into with the technologies that we're increasingly immersing ourselves in. Well, and that's not, as you say, quality in the sense of being alive and awake and attuned to the glory of what we are in terms of the universe.
One very critical aspect of the abstraction that you speak of is the effect of the new technologies on financial markets and Wall Street and on money itself, because what they have tended to do is make money increasingly more of an abstraction than it even was when it was first invented, you know, in the terms of a medium of exchange for goods. And money actually has been called a technology by people who are informed, but it has also perverted the idea of what money actually is to the degree that that system now has been subject to tremendous fragilities and may end up harming us tremendously by impairing and maybe even destroying our ability to manage capital.
Yes. The driving force of computer modeling on Wall Street has been noted, but I think underreported in its ongoing effects. I mean, we see the Wall Street, stock market go up and down precipitously in ways that it never had before these computerized buying and selling programs became almost ubiquitous, as far as my understanding, is that they're driving a great proportion of the trades on the stock markets and the exchanges. And then, of course, there's now the cryptocurrency thing. Just a few days ago, Facebook announced that it was launching a cryptocurrency platform system. And, you know, for those of us who have spent the last 2 years witnessing Facebook's credibility demolished in terms of its ability to manage successfully the dangers of its social media platform, to think of them trying, in essence, establish a new form of universal currency is hilarious, if it wasn't appalling, as appalling as it seems to be.
Yeah. So we're living in a society now where millions of people hate their jobs and they dwell in a built environment, the fiasco of suburbia, as I call it, which can be described as entropy made visible. It's just mm-hmm. hugely punishing to the human spirit. Of course, a lot of it has been made possible by technology, or wouldn't be even possible at all without many of the advancements, so-called, that we've already mentioned. How do you see the living arrangement in America affecting our culture, our society, and the human spirit?
Oh, that to me is such an important question. And again, my hat's off to you for your long history of alerting us and talking about that. And it's, there can be no more important issue. And it directly goes to our ability or inability to get out of the mess we're in, by the way, as you well know. This goes back to the question of what is technology and the fact that it's a systemic phenomenon that is that has overtaken the society and the culture and defines it. I'm a bit of an outlier in the field of philosophy of technology in that I am more determinist than the current academic status quo is very much against determinism. They want to define technology as a socially constructed phenomenon, which I think is inarguable in many respects. But basically, we now have a built world. One of the great historians in technology has written a book called The Human Built World. And we're living in this technological environment, which is just simply and inescapably there, unless you really make an effort to get outside of it and live in the woods. And even there, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, was driven crazy by off-road vehicles and airplanes flying over his cabin in Montana. So it's very hard to escape. But for most of us who live in anything close to a suburban or urban environment, the stress and the input of machines and technologies is just overwhelming. I mentioned that I live in the suburb of Pasadena, California, which is a much more expensive place than my wife and I can really afford. It's known as one of the premier suburbs in the United States, and yet there is not. And I work at home, and there's hardly a minute during the day when I am not assaulted by leaf blowers or helicopters, or I live on a street that doesn't have speed bumps or stop signs, and so drivers drive by at 60 miles an hour on a street that the speed limit, I think, is 25. And you've written wonderfully about the suburban mall culture. All these things are another big debate in the philosophy of technology, and it's, forgive me for going on about this, but it's important. The tension or the symbiosis between capitalism and technology is fundamental in the shaping of America and now world culture over the last century. And there's a debate about which of those two powers is the defining one. Does capitalism define technology and rule technology, or is it the other way around? And I think the relationship is obviously symbiotic. But there's no question that technology has given capitalism, ever since the Industrial Revolution, the power to rule the world and to define the world to its benefit and advantage. And that has given us everything from, an infinite number of Starbucks and McDonald's to the people who are ruling the stock market today through their manipulation of technology. So the spiritual impacts of those powers being manipulated and deployed to the benefit of a few are driving us over the edge, quite simply.
There's something that I would debate you about in terms of the built environment versus the natural environment. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think that as far as human beings are concerned, that it's necessarily a stark choice between those two. For me, what is actually more salient is the astounding artlessness of the man-made world of America, of the suburban world. That is not the case if you go to other cultures. You know, I've been to a small town in France the last few years for a few days each year. What is striking about being in those environments is the sheer amount of purposeful, conscious artistry that goes into every act of assembling that environment, clear down to the handwriting on the chalkboard outside of the bistro. You know, everything is done with that kind of conscious attention that we spoke of a few minutes ago in terms of quality.
I'm very glad to hear that. I don't travel very much, mainly because I find it very difficult to go into airports, which are, about as extreme a manifestation of technological ubiquity as we could imagine.
Yeah, that's why God made Xanax.
Speaking of technologies of consciousness, yes. I'm glad to hear that. I'm sure that you would also acknowledge that the spread of American-style technological environment is getting to be wherever it can, including France.
Yeah, and I think it's considered a curse in a lot of those places.
Yes.
For reasons that are obvious to the people who live there, because they have experienced something a whole lot better.
And good for them.
Most Americans have not.
I hope that continues, and I hope they successfully resist. That's, as you well know, the fundamental issue at this point as far as technology is concerned is how can we resist it? And for me, resistance means how can we get less of it?
Yeah, and we're going to get to that. I don't want to touch on that exactly right
okay.
now. I want to talk to you about some other outstanding, strange features of this whole question, which brings to mind, of course, the issue of Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil is my poster child for what I call techno-narcissism. He kind of invokes a mental state of fantasy, falsity, and titillation that overwhelms all the other reasons for being a human being in the universe. A universe which, by the way, Ray Kurzweil thinks that we're going to invade, take over, and transform. Where do you stand on Ray Kurzweil and the issue of the singularity and all the baggage that comes on that choo-choo train?
Well, as you know from reading my book, I touch periodically on Ray Kurzweil because he, for me, as well as for you, occupies a useful position as the ultimate techno-utopian
maniac.
I mean, you know, he's just out of control, and he's an easy target for that reason, because he sees technology as fixing everything. And the singularity, as you know, is that moment when machine intelligence will exceed human intelligence, and we will be catapulted into some sort of science fiction environment where, again, the promise is that everything will become easy and great. He actually expresses the thought that with the help of technology, our intelligence will, and he uses this phrase, saturate the universe. I have no idea what that means, but it's just, it's not exactly the most appealing thought in the world, if given what's happening in the world already. Yeah. He apparently has quite a following in Silicon Valley where people, you know, techno-utopianism is flourishing in Silicon Valley. I would be very interested to see and hear Kurzweil and other techno-utopians. Another great example is this guy, Kevin Kelly. I would like to hear these people address, and Stuart Brand is another one. I'd like to hear them talk about their responses to the technological disasters that we've all witnessed in the last couple of years, most notably the election of Donald Trump with the help of social media and the, you know, the dismantling of truth and all that stuff that we've heard. And there's been, as you know, quite a backlash against technological utopianism in the last couple of years. I credit myself and I credit you with being way ahead of the curve on being skeptical of that. In fact, I pulled out this morning one of the quotes from your book about Ray Kurzweil, and you say that in his enthusiasm about the utopia that technology is going to take us to, you say, quote, "What about evil, or whatever you want to call the willful malice that the human race has proved itself so well equipped for?" And I think your book came out in 2012.
Yeah, it did.
And, you know, talk about being ahead of the curve. And you were exactly right. These guys never gave a thought about the fact that this could, all this power, this technological power that they exalt with such enthusiasm and joy, they never gave a thought about how it could possibly be misused. And the stupidity of that and the lack of foresight is astonishing. I'm very proud of the last section of my book, which is called Fearless Leaders, which is three chapters which basically address that question that you ask in your book. What kind of precautions are you taking in case this all goes wrong and gets in the wrong hands? Kurzweil is a perfect example of how blind the people in Silicon Valley can be. And I think Facebook's launching of a cryptocurrency platform that would, you know, the ambition is apparently to establish a new form of global currency, is a classic example of how I don't think they will ever learn.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these guys out in Silicon Valley are working on flying cars. They're working on smart cities that they will design. They're working on virtual reality systems. Kurzweil is so enthusiastic about the pornographic possibilities of virtual technology. I mean, it's just hilarious.
Yeah.
And they're not going to stop trying to force this drone deliveries. The technological saturation of the planet Earth has just started, as far as they're concerned. And of course, it's incredibly out of hand already. So,
well, one of the things that I've been very preoccupied for the last couple of years has been the surrender of the thinking classes of America in particular to a kind of amazing inability to think or thoughtlessness. For me, one of the prime examples was the Russiagate frenzy, to which most of the thinking class subscribed, and then they were enormously, tremendously, and nearly psychotically disappointed when it turned out that there was nothing there. Similarly, we hear frequently from people like Elon Musk, the celebrated great genius of our age, and now from Donald Trump, the celebrated stable genius, as he calls himself, of our age, that we're going to make journeys to Mars. It seems to me to be a manifestly idiotic thing, considering, but not limited to, the effects of space travel that distance on the human body. You know, radiation being the only one of many effects. Do you think there's some connection with the negative impacts of the latest technologies, especially virtual realities and communication technologies and the combination of them, with the apparent loss of the ability of the thinking classes to think?
The thinking classes, that's a tricky one because...
certainly the Silicon Valley people are included in that.
Well, yeah, you would think that educated, intelligent people would be able to do better in terms of simple logic. The dream about going to Mars that Musk and Bezos and others, other techno billionaires, I don't know if any of them watched that movie with Matt Damon, or whatever, I can't remember what it was called, but the point is, why would you want to go to Mars? I mean, I admit it's an adventure to go there and maybe come back, but no one wants to live on Mars. That's like living on some exaggerated version of Death Valley.
Yeah, especially when we haven't demonstrated that we can take care of the one planet that is exquisitely suited for us.
Oh, it's absurd. You know, this is not new. I have, as you know, a chapter in the book about the counterculture of the 60s and early 70s and their attitudes toward technology, which is basically, for a while, a back-to-the-land movement and direct and conscious rejection of the technological utopianism. And here comes Stuart Brand, as I describe in this chapter, and he jumps on board. And Stuart Brand... I've read several books about Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog, and it is clear that very early on, Stuart Brand, although the Whole Earth Catalog is associated with the Back to the Land movement, Brand himself became disenchanted very quickly with the how dirty and the communes were and how hard it was to actually grow your own food. And he turned very quickly to various versions and opportunities of technological utopianism, one of which was a proposal by a physicist at Princeton University named Gerard O'Neill that we establish a series of gigantic space stations in permanent orbit or in deep space that would mine various minerals and precious metals from asteroids and would grow their own food in a perfectly controlled environment. I mean, it was the 1970s version of going to Mars without actually going to a planet, these gigantic rotating space cylinders that, and Stuart Brand just jumped on this. He dedicated a whole issue of the successor magazine to the Whole Earth Catalog that he was publishing at the time, called Coevolution Quarterly, dedicated an entire issue to it. And he just could not restrain his excitement about the whole idea, and which was that was in the early 70s. And was supposedly would be a fact no later than the turn of the century, the 2000. This is not new, this kind of And you mentioned in your book the technological fantasy of Edward Bellamy. There's always, it's very tempting to imagine these science fiction utopian fantasies, which is just another way of saying, get me out of here because I don't like it here and it's going to be better somewhere else. And it's just a fantasy.
Yeah. I want to jump to some of your conclusions, which kind of jibe with some of mine. I guess your principal conclusion is that in thinking about where we're going and what kind of a society or what the destiny of the human project is going to be, that we might just begin by thinking about cutting back on everything. Why don't you tell us about that idea?
It's funny. I did an interview when the book first came out with Ralph Nader. He started off the interview for his radio and podcast saying, well, I have very mixed feelings about this book. And that kind of threw me. And it turned out that I did not provide, in his estimation and from his perspective in my book, adequate specific steps and solutions that we could provide that would fix the problem. And I make it very clear in my conclusion to the book that you have to be very careful about solutions because there's a kind of a programmatic technological idea to the fact that if we just do this and this and this, everything will be okay. And it's really, as you know, not that simple. But I do say, and I feel very strongly, that the first and most fundamental step is to just do and get by on less in very significant and serious ways. I mean, the waste and opulence of the American culture in particular is just, it's appalling, and I don't have to tell you how unsustainable it is. It's amazing to me how little the option of just simply doing with less is actively considered. I mean, we're very seriously now considering a return to nuclear power because, you know, we're running out of fossil fuels and alternative clean energy is not going to really, as Donald Trump says, honey, I want to watch TV, but there's no power, you know. in other words, we'll do anything to sustain this incredibly greedy and destructive and unsustainable pattern of living that we've gotten ourselves addicted to. We could get along fine with, a fraction of the consumption that we habitually do. And it's just given the catastrophe of climate change, especially, and all the other assorted environmental disasters that we're experiencing, we have to just cut it way, way back. That's the ultimate solution as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that implies a number of interesting and troubling things. One is, and I think that you did imply this, that relying on technological patches and workarounds to solve some of the epic problems that we're facing beats a path directly to Joseph Tainter's idea that overinvestments in hypercomplexity lead to collapse. So that's one thing that I think is enormously problematical. But another one is that, it gets back to what we were talking about in the beginning, the idea that, you're proposing to cut back on everything, but the way down or the path to simplification may end up implying a great deal of disorder, the loss of systems, and a lot of knock-on effects that we just can't reckon. And that goes hand in hand with another thing. Forgive me for going on about this, but, so many of the techno problem solving gang, the sort of the techno narcissist posse, seems to assume that all other elements of the story will remain as they are now, including our energy resources, our mineral resources, the geophysical conditions on the planet Earth, which are clearly going through some kind of a change. and the availability of capital, which is to say, you know, reserve wealth of one real kind or another. I'm not sure that that happens. And so I have to conclude two things. One, that we're not going to change voluntarily, that we will change when circumstances compel us to change. That's the first thing. The second thing is the question of our destination when we are compelled to make those changes. And I kind of suspect that it means that we're going medieval, if we're lucky. Yeah, and I often have used that as a gag because it is sort of sounds funny, but it's not really a gag. I kind of think that that's where we're headed.
I'm very pessimistic, and I'm sure you've been accused of that.
Yeah, I don't consider that a pessimistic idea. I just consider it a reality.
Well, I think that what you're saying is that we've gotten ourselves into a situation where there's no easy way out, and that it's going to be painful and ugly. I don't disagree. I mean, I talked earlier about de facto technological autonomy, and that's the idea that we're so committed to these systems and to the economic way of life that we've devised for ourselves, that to uncouple from that is going to be, it could be very painful. But what direction do we take? I don't know of any more logical and helpful step to take other than to just do less, because the weight of it is what's killing us. And all the capitalists are thinking, do less, my God, I've got to grow my quarterly earnings. You know, we have to constantly do more, or I'm not going to get my bonus at the end of the year. We just can't do that. And I know it's going to be painful for people, but God, you know, you don't have to live in a $1 million house. You don't have to have 12 TVs. You know, you don't have to, all this crap. It is possible to do less, and I don't know of any other, again, I'm like you, I don't know what, I'm more radical than I was. My book was first published in 2016, just 3 weeks before Trump was elected, by the way, which didn't help it get much attention. It just came out in paperback, and in that time, I've become more radical in terms of being sympathetic to radical steps to address technological overreach. And I won't go into detail about that. I'm not a fan of Ted Kaczynski, by the way. In any event, we just have to do less. I'll just leave.
I got to tell you a funny story. A friend of mine just retired as a history professor at Dartmouth College. And he told me when the Unabomber Manifesto came out about 15 years ago or so, he said that when that came out, all of his colleagues or many of his colleagues around the Dartmouth campus were going around high-fiving each other on Ted Kaczynski's manifesto, despite the fact that the guy, you know, was a murderer. He had killed people in the service of his mission. There was quite a consensus that he was correct about what he was saying.
Well, you've touched on something that is a point of irritation to me, and I've heard exactly the same thing, and it's just all over the place. New York Magazine ran a feature probably, I guess it's about a year ago now, about a whole new generation of followers of Ted Kaczynski who think he's just a genius. And I've written about this in a couple of places. Number one, if you read the Unabomber Manifesto, it's obviously the work of a guy who's off his rocker. A significant proportion of it has nothing to do with technology. It's basically rants about political correctness and leftist college professors and political correctness. So much so that Andrews Breivik, the terrorist who murdered, I can't remember how many children.
Like 80 or something.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, just a slaughter of about 80 children in Norway, who was basically a right-wing anti-immigration. His whole thing was that Europe was being overrun by immigrants from Asian and other undesirable countries. He adopted word for word sections of Kaczynski's manifesto in his own manifesto before he went on to advocate the use of genetic engineering to get rid of all these undesirable races that were, overwhelming Europe. So he wasn't anti-technology, but he was he found a lot of what Kaczynski had to say about political correctness and leftist liberalism and all that stuff to be very sympathetic. But to get back to Ted, the ideas on technology that people are so impressed with in the Unabomber Manifesto are not Ted's. They're borrowed from other thinkers that he read, most especially a French philosopher, a sociologist named Jacques Ellul, who wrote a book called The Technological Society, which Ted's brother, David Kaczynski, said Ted considered his Bible in Ted's earlier days and when he was first starting to articulate his ideas about technology. This is something that those of us who have gotten into the history and philosophy of technology, we find it very annoying that people don't understand the depth of thinking and scholarship that's gone into these questions, addressing these questions over the years. I wrote an essay at one point, Ted Kaczynski's favorite philosopher and mine, meaning that I agree with him that Jacques Ellul is a genius and has articulated all the ideas that Ted borrowed for his manifesto. But Jacques Ellul is also splits his time as a philosopher of technology and as a theologian and does not ever argue in favor of killing anyone. And it's appalling to me, and you alluded to this, that people would consider Ted Kaczynski a hero when his first act of terrorism was planting a bomb on a commercial airliner.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it went off and caused a smoke to fill the cabin, and the plane did an emergency landing, but it did not explode. Wow. And destroy the plane. I mean, this guy put a bomb in a parking lot that could have killed a child who came along. It happened to be picked up by the manager of a computer store who was killed. I mean, come on. He never articulated in any clear way what his campaign of terror was aimed at or how he would achieve any of the goals that he aimed for. The FBI, chased him for over a decade. And for almost all of that time, until his manifesto was published in the New York Times and Washington Post, they had no idea what he was campaigning against.
Yeah.
Because his targets were so strange and unexplained that there was no coherent pattern. They had no idea what his cause was. And then the manifesto was published, and the rest is history. They caught him.
Well, I don't think that we want to become a nation of Ted Kaczynskis, for sure. I think your idea of cutting back on everything is a good start. I have a different way of phrasing what's coming down the pike at us. I call it a timeout from technological progress. The real question is whether it's going to be a very long timeout or a permanent timeout or what. And we really don't know. We've seen this before. When the Roman Empire collapsed in Great Britain, the people of Britain, without their Roman overlords, lost a lot of knowledge. They forgot how to make pottery after a century or so. They stopped bathing. Things turned out very different. And, eventually they went through another 1,500 years of history and became the British Empire. But they had quite a time out from their intermezzo as a Roman colony, which probably lasted about as long as the American Republic has, and indeed the whole Industrial Revolution so far, which we might generally date back to about 1800. I guess, as Bob Dylan used to say, things have changed and things can change.
I am very sympathetic with your thoughts about the idea that the change that will come will have to be forced. You will know from having read my book that one of the things that I, one of the most fundamental convictions I have about technology is that its central drive is to expand its purview of influence.
Yes.
And I don't believe that that drive will be hindered or reversed without either staunch resistance or in some forceful manner, because the drive and the power forward is whether you think of it as technology driving forward by itself or with the help of the technologists, obviously both are true. Again, Ray Kurzweil, you know, he just can't wait for it to drive forward. And as you also know, we're stuck in this paradigm where we think that what's going to save us from technology is more technology.
Yeah.
And the absurdity of that logic is just obvious. Yes, we probably will have to be forced into it, and it's going to be very painful. It already is. I wrote an essay on the applicability of just war principles to trying to deal with climate change, which would be basically argued that it would be quite legitimate from just war principles for third world countries or any country to attack the polluting systems of first world countries in order to save themselves. So however it comes down, and we see the massive immigration crises that are going on today, they're only going to get worse. And it's going to be hairy. I don't know in detail how Hiroshima and Nagasaki recovered from the nuclear holocaust to which they were subjected in World War II, but, you know, it's going to be ugly.
Yeah, and let's not forget that Hiroshima and Nagasaki recovered against the background of a world which in other places was still operating pretty okay, namely the United States. And so it was really with our assistance. Doug Hill, we're going to conclude this discussion about your book, Not So Fast, Thinking Twice About Technology, which is published in paperback by the University of Georgia Press, available at all of the usual suspects who sell books. And if you have a local bookstore, as you probably do in Pasadena, if you have one elsewhere, try to order a book through your local bookstore. It'll really help things. Doug, maybe we'll check back with you in another 6 months or a year, see where we're at, see how things have moved, because it does seem like events are in the driver's seat now, not really personalities.
Yeah, the change has happened, man. And obviously, events in Washington and Silicon Valley, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, and by coincidence, the title of my next book is called Now What?
I look forward to it,
Jim. Coming out in March of 2020. So, Doug, it's been a pleasure, and we will ride again.
Thanks, Jim. It's been a pleasure.